It's business time, baby.
The Solomonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to the Solomonster Sounds Off here for this Memorial Day weekend, Sunday, May 29, 2016. I am the Solomonster. Hope everybody's having a great weekend. This is a very special all-mailbag edition of the podcast. I am currently out of the country, and so we're doing things a little bit different here this week and then returning to our normal format next week. I want to just mention up front that you can support the podcast the usual ways. You can use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Get yourself a 30-day trial of the Audible service. You get one free audio book that you get to cash in on and you get to keep no matter what. But you got to use our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Also, don't forget you can buy a shirt in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. We've got over 24 shirts to choose from. You can make a PayPal donation at any time on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side. You can click that. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this podcast. If you contributed this past week, just be aware we are not doing any shout-outs here on this show. We're going to be doing them next week. So I did not forget about you. If you made a donation over the last several days, I will get to you and everyone else next weekend. I promise. So let's get right into it here. You guys have been sending me questions, a lot of questions over the last several weeks. Actually, the questions never stop. So I have taken a bunch of different ones, some that apply to the current product, a lot of questions that deal with historical events and things that happened many, many years ago, which are the questions I tend to like the most. So let's just get into it here. We're going to start out with Billy in Des Moines, Iowa. I was recently watching some old Saturday Night's Main Events from 1987 on the network and got to thinking about how crazy it was that the Honky Tonk Man held the Intercontinental title for over a year from the middle of 87 until SummerSlam 88. I know his gimmick was to get cheap wins by DQ or countout to keep his belt, but don't you find it surprising he didn't lose it even once during that entire time? Do you think Vince didn't have faith in any of his mid-card babyfaces at that time? The roster was pretty stacked. Why did he hold the belt for so long? And out of the possible contenders during that time, is there anyone you would have liked to have seen get a run with the IC strap? I don't think it's surprising at all that Honky Tonk Man held the championship for that. I mean, you could argue that him of all people, but I mean, in terms of the length of his run, I just don't find it surprising. I mean, guys generally held on to those titles a lot longer back then because you didn't have as much TV as you do now. Especially now with 3 hours. And even now with 3 hours, they don't do as many title changes on TV just like any given week on Raw. Even as much as they did maybe 6, 7 years ago, 10, 12 years ago. I mean, you can go back all the way to the Attitude Era and even the era right after that. We saw title changes far more often back then than we do now. They've actually gotten a little bit better about that. But back in that era, it would have been more surprising to see that belt, you know, as a hot potato and change hands 3 or 4 times in the course of a year. So that I didn't find surprising. And you have to understand, you didn't have to, do that kind of thing because the stories they had were planned out months in advance. So they gave them time to play out. They had a long-term plan. Okay, we're going to keep the title on this guy and 6 months from now. Or look at the Mega Powers. You know, Savage won the championship at WrestleMania 4. I don't doubt in my mind they had the plan already hatched in their mind. You know, I think Hogan maybe was going away for a few months to do, I think it was No Holds Barred. Hogan's going to come back. We're going to keep the Mega Powers thing going. And, you know, Elizabeth. And then there's going to be a wedge in between them. And we're going to go all the way to WrestleMania 5. So I don't doubt they had that story planned at least a year in advance. And it turned out to be one of the greatest storylines they've ever done. So you saw a lot more of that back then. The thing with Honky Tonk Man is, you know, when he first won the championship, I doubt very seriously the plan was to keep the title on him for as long as they did. Even when he won the belt, you know, he wasn't supposed to. You know, Ricky Steamboat, the whole story there is Steamboat asked for time off. He wanted to be at home with his wife. I think they were either having a kid or they had just had a child. And he wanted to spend time at home with his family. And Vince, you know, Vince didn't take too kindly to that because he had just put Steamboat over Savage at WrestleMania at the Silverdome, put the championship on him. And at that time, a hell of a lot more so than today, that Intercontinental title, you know, it had a lot of cachet. It had a lot of prestige. That was kind of the workhorse champion in the company. If the WWF champion was the face of the company, which is what Hogan was, I don't know that Hogan was working circles around guys like Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat, you know, or even Tito Santana or Don Morocco. That's what that title was really known for. So you had to be on the road. You had to make all the tapings. I mean, you had to commit yourself to it 100%. So in a way, I can understand Vince being upset and saying, hey, listen, we put you over this big at this show just a few months ago. Now you want to take time off. What the hell? So they had to get the championship off of Steamboat. And one story was that they wanted to put the title on Butch Reed. I don't know if this is 100% true or not, but I've heard the story. I'm sure some of you have. They wanted to put the title on the natural Butch Reed, who was on the roster at the time. And then Butch Reed no-showed the taping that night. And so they went with Honky Tonk Man instead. Hogan saw him walking down a hallway and looked at Vince and said, hey, how about that guy? And so they went with Honky Tonk Man. Now, Butch Reed, I think, was there. I think Butch Reed was in the dressing room that night because they had this celebration taped when Honky came to the back. And who the hell knows? I mean, maybe they didn't even tape it that night. But Honky's in the dressing room and all the heels are celebrating with him. And I think there might have been champagne bottles and stuff. And I believe Butch Reed was there. He was physically there. He was in the locker room. He was part of the whole celebration. And you can see him with the other heels celebrating. So again, maybe it's an urban legend. Maybe it's true and he just arrived late to the taping and that was his punishment. He kind of lost his spot. He didn't make it in time. I don't know. I don't know for sure. The stuff with Savage, and Honky Tonk has talked about this before. They wanted him to drop the championship to Savage. Remember that main event special in February of 88? That was the big show. Hogan versus Andre, the big WrestleMania rematch. It did like 33 million viewers that night, which is still the largest audience in history for a show. That was the show where the evil Hebner twins screwed Hogan out of the belt. And Andre talked about how happy he was to win the tag team championship. That's what he said. That's what he called it. Twice. Not even once, twice he called it the tag team title. So anyway, they wanted Savage to win the IC. Honky said no. He thought it would, and this is his claim. He said it would kill his drawing power with Turner if he wanted to jump ship, and that many people, 30 million people, saw him lose to Randy Savage. I don't know if he was secretly negotiating with Turner at the time to make a jump or if he's completely full of shit and just didn't want to do a job because he knew that title was his meal ticket and once he lost it, his push is probably going to be over. It's very possible that was the case as well. So anyway, they didn't do the title change. Savage instead, I guess is something of a consolation prize. A month later, he ended up with the WWF title. So he would have lost the title there on that main event show if the company had their way. So it wasn't a case, we're going to keep the title on him for 14 months or 15 months. They wanted it off of him in February. Forget August. Now, you know, was he a draw? I think he actually did pretty well as champion. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, you know, I've read about how some guys did at the live events and whatnot at the time. For example, I know Randy Savage is WWF champion when he won it in 88. He was actually a pretty... not even decent. He was a pretty well-drawing world champion in the program. He had the matches with Ted DiBiase. He did very well. If anything, you probably could have kept the title on Savage even longer than they did. You could have given him a honky-tonk type reign with the belt. So some guys did better than others. I think Honky did pretty well when he had the title. I know he headlined plenty of shows with Savage for the Intercontinental title. Because back then they had like their A crew, their B crew. Like Hogan would always be the A crew. Sometimes they'd have a B or even a C crew. Because they could run three different shows in one night in different cities. I mean, the schedule, you think the schedule for these guys now is crazy. It was insanity back then. No wonder they all turned to freaking drugs and alcohol. So I was at one of those shows. I mean, the very first show I ever went to was... a show that had Savage and Honky in the main event with Jimmy Hart above the ring in a shark cage. And it was a Intercontinental title match. It wasn't for the WWF belt. It was for the IC. And so I know for a fact that they had different loops and they had different tours where those guys were headlining. And I would have to imagine that Honky did pretty well. If he was a complete bomb and they realized, hey, we can't headline shows with this guy, I doubt they would have kept, you know, their second most important championship on him for, you know, 15 months. And, you know, back then, you can't underestimate the power of a good chicken shit heel, which is what Honky Tonk Man was. He was the kind of heel you wanted just badly to see him get his ass kicked because he was so annoying and he was so arrogant. He was so full of himself and with the guitar and playing songs and singing his song and all that kind of stuff. You can't underestimate the power of that. People wanting to buy a ticket to see somebody get their ass kicked. And Honky was very good at being hated. He still is today. Still pisses people off. So I wouldn't doubt that he did well with the belt. As far as who else, you know, I would have liked to have seen get a run with it. I mean, I was a big fan, you know, back then when I was a kid, I was a big fan of Hogan. I was a big fan of Macho Man. Jake the Snake was another one. I guess Jake would have been a good choice. Jake never held any kind of title in WWE. I mean, I guess he didn't have to. But you know what? Neither did Roddy Piper. Roddy Piper didn't need to be a champion to be as over and successful as he was. But you know what? It was cool. When he won the Intercontinental title at the Royal Rumble in 1992, that was a cool moment. Seeing him standing there, with a big smile on his face, holding the Intercontinental title above his head, people going nuts. That was a great moment. So you didn't have to do that. And at that point, I don't want to say Piper was washed up in 1992. I actually think Piper was maybe in the best shape of his career physically in 92. But he was past his peak run. His peak run was in the mid-80s, the stuff with Hogan, Mr. T. He was well past that. He had already left. And I don't know if he failed or what, but he didn't make the big splash in Hollywood he wanted to, so he came back. So this was his second run. You didn't have to do that. You didn't have to put a title on him, but they did, and I'm glad they did. So I just think that's worth mentioning, but I think it would have been cool in a similar way to see Jake at some point get the championship. You know, maybe keep it in the same bag with the Snake and then take it out when he gets to the ring. I would say if I had one more name I wanted to throw in there, I'd put DiBiase in there, Million Dollar Man. I think he would have made a great I think he would have made a great WWF champion. And he might have been, had it not been for Honky Tonk Man refusing to do the job to Savage. But I think he would have made a great Intercontinental champion also. You know, the guy was so cool, they had a belt made for him. See, that's a boss right there. It's like, fuck your titles, I'll have my own made. Joe from Nottingham, England, with Galloway and EC3 showing WWE missed their potential, I thought it would be interesting to ask for the other side of the coin. My question is, who is the biggest waste of potential that TNA had, and in hindsight, clearly misused? We could be here a while. We'd be here even longer if we were talking WWE. First name that comes to mind, and my choice, would be Samoa Joe. And I think of other big names. I think you could throw Tanahashi and Okada in there. There might be some people who don't realize that, but yes, TNA had Tanahashi and Okada. I don't remember if it was at the same time, but they had them on the TNA roster. Obviously, this was before they hit it big in Japan. But TNA just didn't see the talent, I guess, or the potential in them, and they came and they went. They went back to Japan, and they became two of the biggest stars of all time. So you got to include them in the list. But yeah, I think, you know, the thing with them, though, with Tanahashi and Okada, who's to say how they would have gotten over to an American audience, even if TNA did push them, just to defend TNA a little bit, not too much. But I don't know how much they would have really gotten over with the American audience had they pushed them. But Joe, to me, Joe is worse. Joe is far worse. Joe came in, I guess it would have been 2005, straight off Ring of Honor. He was the hottest thing in Ring of Honor, had that long 21-month, I think it was, world title reign. That's where he really made a name for himself. He came in to TNA in 05, and this guy, he was probably the hottest free agent in wrestling at the time. He comes in, and they started off very good with him. You know, he went undefeated for a while. He was booked as this killing machine. He had this great feud with Kurt Angle. They had the cage match where they did their biggest buy rate ever to this day on pay-per-view. And then after that, it was all downhill. They took a guy with so much buzz around him. They put a fucking tattoo on his face. They had him kidnapped and kept coming back and then running around with a giant machete. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you see how NXT, you see how NXT is using him right now? He is the best champion in the entire company. I've said that before, I'll say it again, and that includes Roman Reigns and Kalisto, because we all know what a great champion he was with the U.S. title. I mean, he is the best thing going in that company, and number two right behind him is probably Asuka. I mean, you want to compare NXT to the WWE main roster, I mean, they're kicking ass right now. And Joe is a lot older. I mean, look, Joe's over a decade older than he was when he first came into TNA. He's not a spring chicken. He's got a lot of miles under his belt. And he's doing the best work of his career. I would argue even more than ROH. He is doing the best work of his career right now. Just the way he's got that character, that badass character nailed down, his work in the ring, everything about the guy is as good now as it's ever been in his entire career. And TNA had that. They had that. He was there. They had him for a decade. And they didn't know what to do with him. And you see how NXT is using him with all of the talent that they have. And that just speaks volumes, I think, about the way TNA used them. It's an indictment on TNA. Kieran from Dundee, Scotland, with the announcement of Samoa Joe against Finn Balor in a steel cage at TakeOver. Buy or sell on escaping the cage or winning by pinfall or submission? I'm going to buy on the escape the cage rule, only because I grew up on that. Yeah, I grew up in the Northeast. I was a WWF fan. And I know that's not how it used to be. It was always the chain link, you know, mesh fence, and you would pin the guy. Although they had escape the cage rules back then also. But the whole thing about a cage is, you know, you want to keep the guys inside, and they're going to kill each other until there's one guy left standing, right? And the guy, you're going to pin your opponent. But that's not what I grew up on. I grew up on you have to escape the cage, and both feet have to touch the floor. And you had the blue bar cage, and I still am, really, a very big fan of that. I don't hate the idea of pinning your opponent in the cage. Maybe you can give people the option. You know, get the best of both worlds. You can win by either way. But I'm more of a escape the cage fan. And I think you can build drama that way. You know, both guys going down at the same time, one on each side. Who's going to hit first? We've seen that before. So, just a matter of personal preference, I guess. Big Zeus in DC. Would it be fair to trace the birth of the anti-Cena movement to the night RVD beat John Cena for the title at One Night Stand 05? Prior to that, Cena had been the most super babyface since the glory days of Hogan. But once again, ECW and its hardcore fans have a way of shifting the wrestling culture, and it seems to me that since the Fuck You Cena chant that night, it became a Fuck You Cena movement that has yet to wane. I could be wrong, but I'd appreciate your thoughts on it if you haven't given them already. Oh, Zeus. There is so much wrong with this question. First of all, it was One Night Stand 06, not 05. Minor point. Actually, not so minor because it completely screws up the timeline here. But before I get into that, most super babyface since Hogan, really? I think Stone Cold and The Rock might have a little something to say about that. No, the anti-Cena hate, to me, can be traced back to SummerSlam in 05. He had the match with Chris Jericho. You had the dueling chants. That, to me, was the first time I can remember really seeing that. When Cena got drafted to Raw in June, he got a hero's welcome. You know, Jericho, the whole thing was Jericho didn't know the big star who had just been drafted to Raw. He was doing a highlight reel. All of a sudden, Cena's music hits. Everybody goes nuts. Jericho is shocked. The fans are shocked. Cena comes out. You'd think he was, you know, he was just idolized by everyone. He got a hero's welcome. Somewhere in there, somewhere from mid-June to August when they did that SummerSlam match, unless it started that very night at SummerSlam, something happened. Something happened in that July-August timeframe that began to turn the tide against him. And I think SummerSlam was really that first manifestation of, again, the dueling chants and let's go Cena, Cena sucks, and that kind of thing. And it made for a great atmosphere. I think it made the match better than it even actually was. But that's as far back as it goes for me. I think before that, John Cena was doing just fine. And like I said, something happened, whatever that was, some kind of resentment, or maybe people started to sense that the John Cena character they remember from SmackDown maybe was starting to be toned down. Maybe not. That wasn't the PG era. The PG era didn't kick in until 08, so that really wouldn't make any sense. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was around that time that it began. And by One Night Stand the following year, you know, the RVD match that you mentioned, it was already happening for almost a year at that point. I mean, John Cena got booed against Triple H at WrestleMania in Chicago that year. So it had started long before that. Jonathan from Orlando, WWE runs so many house shows a year, I feel they should show all of them on the network. You don't even necessarily need to have commentary for them. I just feel having every house show really fills up the network with good content. They would get more people watching their network with a house show live event on instead of a Beyond the Ring rerun. I also feel dark matches and skits that happen after Raw and SmackDown should appear on the network. Do you think doing all of this is a good idea, or do you think it's too much clutter and should stick to just once in a blue moon live specials? It's way too much. I mean, look, I advocated for airing house shows or parts of house shows on the network. You know, this was years ago when the network was first starting up. And there were people who said, oh, you're nuts. You're going to put house shows on the network? Nobody cares. My whole idea is you're not going to put every house show on the network. You would either have cut-ins where, let's say at a given event, if it's a bigger event, maybe in, Chicago, or it doesn't even have to be a major city. If you've got a Renee Young or a Tom Phillips or somebody there, every blue moon you could do a live hookup. You can have them standing there, the matches are going on in the background, and they do sporadic cut-ins, you know, to certain matches. You know, let's join this match in progress or something, and you show some of the action, especially if there's a unique match. So my whole thought process is, okay, let's say you're having a house show, and Nakamura is on that loop, okay, he's on that tour, or even just the one show. He's not on the main roster yet, but here he is, he's on the show, and he's having a match with Chris Jericho. I'm not advocating that you show the entire match or the entire show on the network, but you could do a cut-in in the middle of a Nakamura-Jericho match, and you show, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes of it, and then you cut away and go back to your other programming or something else maybe that's going on at the show, maybe a backstage promo. You kind of whet people's appetite, like, oh man, I want to see the rest of that match. In theory, the next time WWE comes to your town, I mean, who knows if Nakamura will be on the show, but the point is, you want to get people more interested in buying a ticket to go to the shows. You don't want them, because people in their mind already think these live events, who cares, nothing big ever happens. I mean, NXT just did a world title change on a house show, but you don't see that on the main roster. It's like the circus is coming to town, and you'll get to see all your favorite performers, and then, you know, and then they're gone, and that's it, and nothing of any significance really ever happens. The goal or the idea is to show people, hey, you know, you can get matches to see things on these shows that you won't see on TV. So the next time we come to town, buy a ticket and come on down. So that's kind of my thought process behind it. I'd be okay with putting the occasional full house show on the network. Full house. But I would not air all of them. I think that's lunacy. You're not going to air all of them on the network. Then what's the point of even, you know, having them? The whole point is you want to get people to buy tickets to come out. If you're just going to show everything on TV, you know, you're going to clutter the network now with live events. You're having matches. Remember, a lot of these house shows have matches that are going to happen at the next pay-per-view. You're going to have Roman Reigns against AJ Styles, let's say, coming up at Extreme Rules, which we just had, right? But you're not going to be airing just a random house show a week before on the network that happens to have Roman Reigns against AJ Styles in the main event. That defeats the whole purpose. Why are you going to do that? So no, I think airing all the house shows is ridiculous. I would not do that. I like the occasional live specials, but I think every now and then, just to have a normal, not a live special, just like a house show, like you said, no commentary. Maybe if you're not going to air the whole show, have somebody there. You can have a hookup and do cut-ins on certain matches and stuff like that. I don't know. I feel like it would give the network even more of a special feel. And also, you want to be tuned into the network, right? Because you never know. You never know when they're going to cut in, where they're going to be, what they're going to be doing. It's just an idea. Horacio. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. From Phoenix, Arizona. Do you think Sheamus' heel turn coming back from injury killed his push Before the injury, he seemed pretty over as a babyface. Whose idea was it for him to turn heel? I think it was his idea. I think he wanted to do it, or it was pitched to him and he was on board. He was completely in support of it, I know that. But I'm going to disagree with you on what you just said. He was as stale as freaking month-old bread as a babyface on that roster when he got hurt. I think that was when he hurt his shoulder in the ladder match. They weren't doing anything with him. He was bouncing around. He was having just random matches, just floating around from one opponent to the next, wrestling Dolph Ziggler all the time. He had nothing going on for him, and nobody cared. The best thing that could have happened to him was to bring him back as a heel. And look, he went and changed his whole look. He had the mohawk. He had the nose ring. He tried to make himself look as different as possible. I mean, he still had the same pasty white skin. Can't really do much about that. Trust me, I know. But he went out of his way. He went all in. He was going to change everything, and he started getting the "you look stupid" chants, but that was great, right? Okay, they're chanting "you look stupid," but that's now part of your gimmick. Now people have something to chant at you when you come out. That's what you want. So the best thing that could have happened to him was to turn him heel, because as a babyface, the guy was fucking stale, man. I still remember that. I was like, God. I think even I was calling for a heel turn at the time. I was like, you got to do something different with this guy. It's like, there's just nothing going on here. So, Dylan from Camden, Arkansas. I started watching wrestling back in the mid-90s with WCW at the time. Once WCW closed down, I stopped for a while, and I started watching WWE for the first time ever in 2003. In recent years, I've gone back and watched stuff from the Attitude Era and stumbled across the Rock versus Triple H Iron Man match from 2000. Why did The Undertaker interfere in that match, and do you think his interference took away from the match as a whole? No, not at all. Not at all. I think it made the match even better. Aside from the fact that they kind of botched the timing of it. If you go back and watch that match there, Undertaker went to go tombstone Triple H. Unfortunately, time ran out. The buzzer went off before he actually hit the move. I'm sure everybody involved was not very happy about that. That was a little weird. But I mean, my God, where was that show? That was in, it was like Oklahoma or Kentucky. I think it was Louisville. I think it was in Louisville, Kentucky. The building just came unglued. When Undertaker rode down to the ring on that motorcycle, and he started killing dudes left and right, it was fucking great. I loved it. It was great. It might be my favorite of all the Iron Man matches. Still, to this day, Rock vs. Triple H, I don't think gets enough credit. I think that to me was the most fun Iron Man match that they've ever done. Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, probably a better wrestling match. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, probably a better wrestling match. Especially Bret and Shawn, though. Not a bad match. Way, way overrated. Rock versus Triple H, you really don't ever hear about them. Yeah, because Rock and Triple H are not Bret Hart. They're not Shawn Michaels. They're not Kurt Angle. But they went out there, and I think it ended up being like 6 falls to 5 or something like that, and I just thought it was a fun match. But you weren't watching at the time, I guess, in 99. So what you didn't know is the last time we saw Undertaker. Okay, so when Undertaker came back at that show, he was gone for well over 6... It might have been like 8 months or 9 months or something like that. What happened was, in the fall of 99, he had some injuries, maybe like a hip injury. I think he was going to have surgery, so he had to go away. And it must have been a sudden thing, because they had him scheduled for... There was a pay-per-view main event. It was like a 6-man match for the championship. He was going to be in it. And I remember, I want to say it was SmackDown. There was a backstage segment. Undertaker was going to leave the building. Vince stopped him, said, "Where are you going?" And Undertaker was basically like, "I'm out of here." And I think Vince might have been like, "Well, if you leave, you're out of the title match." And Undertaker basically was like, "All right, piss off." And he left. And that was the last we ever saw or heard of The Undertaker until 2000. When he came back, he was the American Badass. Completely different look, completely different character. So I bring that up because you were wondering, well, why would Undertaker interfere in this match? And I don't even know if they ever bothered to explain it, but I looked at it and figured, okay, well, the last time we saw Undertaker, him and Vince had a beef. And Vince basically, you know, took him out of the championship match, and, right, there was some friction there. So now when Undertaker comes back, Vince is trying to screw The Rock, because all the whole McMahon-Helmsley group and DX and everybody there in the ring kicking Rock's ass. Here comes Undertaker. Undertaker's back. to get one over on Vince, to get his revenge on Vince McMahon. He wasn't trying to help The Rock. He was going after Vince. And in fact, I think he actually caught, I think he tagged Vince with a right hand right on the bridge of the nose. I don't know if he broke Vince's nose or not, but when Vince came up, he had a bloody nose. So he got him pretty good. Unfortunately for Undertaker, though, it backfired, and Triple H won the championship. But that was a great match. Russ from Freehold, New Jersey. In 2002, there were 7 WWE champions. Why do you think there were so many champions that year prior to the creation of the World Heavyweight title? Do you think the company did not have confidence in any of the title holders for an extended period of time? No, I mean, that's just how it was back then, man. I mean, the title was a hot potato. I think Rock and Triple H exchanged it like 3 or 4 times in 2000. In 2002, Hogan... Okay, so Hogan comes back. He's in the NWO. He has the match with Rock. Gets over as a babyface like gangbusters. They immediately change him back to the red and yellow. So now Hogan's a hot babyface. Triple H, who had just had this big comeback story from the quad tear. He was out for like 9 months. He comes back. He wins the Royal Rumble. He goes to WrestleMania. He wins the championship. And a month later, they take the title off him and put it on Hulk Hogan. I don't think that was in the long-term plans. So they went with what's hot. That, you know, Vince saw the crowd reactions and he said, oh man, Hogan's really over. We ought to put the title on him. So that's why they put the title on Hogan, rather. Otherwise, I don't think Triple H was dropping that thing until later in the year. So they put the title on Hogan. And then, of course, what happens? They realize, oh, this isn't working. Hogan was a total flop. So a month later, they put the title on Undertaker. Well, then Austin walks out in June. He leaves the company. Leaves them in a lurch. So they have to call Rock back. Rock came back a lot earlier than he would have had Austin not left. So Rock comes back. They decide, okay, we're going to put the title on Rock. We'll have Rock be a transitional champion, which is exactly what he was. He lost it a month later to Brock Lesnar. He put over the new guy, and now they had a new star. They had a new champion in Brock. And then I know they took it off Brock a few months later, which I think was stupid, but... That at least explains 2 of the title changes. I don't really know that they were planned that far in advance. They just kind of happened because of other circumstances. But even if you take those 2 away, that's still 5 title changes in a year. That's a lot. That is a lot. Mark from Massachusetts. Randy Savage is my favorite wrestler of all time. Good man. And watching him from 97 to 99 was interesting to say the least. I've been watching some ECW hardcore TVs from those same years, and it got me thinking, how do you think Macho Man would have been received in ECW? And do you think he'd have made it work? I think, look, the ECW crowd cheered Sid when he came in. It was around that same time. It was like 97, 98, I think they brought in Sid. And he was like the biggest star that you ever saw. I mean, he was just very well received by that crowd. I'm positive that Randy Savage would have received every bit as much of an ovation at ECW as Sid did. He would have been received very well. Hogan, not so much. Hogan's a big name. Maybe at first people would be starstruck, but believe me, I don't think Hogan would have gotten a very warm reception at ECW. Savage, though, I think he would have been fine. Could he have made it work? No, because Paul Heyman couldn't pay him enough money, so he never would have gone there anyway. Physically, you know, 97 Savage, I think, would have been fine. By 99, he was in pretty rough shape. I mean, physically, like his knees. I don't think he'd have done much wrestling, but, you know, they would have found something for him to do. I mean, look, when Brian Pillman came in, did he even wrestle a match in ECW? Did he wrestle a single match? He might have. All I remember when he came into ECW was him wrestling a pencil, him threatening to urinate in the ring. Okay, he was the wild and crazy guy, and then he went over to WWF. But he had the ankle injury, so, you know, again, he couldn't wrestle, but they found stuff for him to do. He was the loose cannon. Savage, let me tell you something. Savage was probably always a loose cannon, but in the late 90s, he was even more of a loose cannon. He was a crazy man. So it could have been that same Pillman-type thing that they could have, you know, had Savage doing at the time. And it would have been a big boon for ECW to have a star of that caliber. Maybe they could have used Savage as inroads with TV networks and stuff. I mean, maybe he didn't carry the same kind of name as the Hulk Hogan name, but Randy Savage was a pretty big star. He was a pretty big name. People knew who he was. ECW might have been able to use him. you know, to their benefit and try to expand and grow and get even bigger than they were. Lorenzo from Fresno. At In Your House 95, Shawn Michaels was going to wrestle Dean Douglas for his Intercontinental title and mysteriously came out with a black eye. He was also very oddly there to give up the title to Douglas. Apparently the cause of this black eye and his forfeiture of the belt was in Syracuse before the match where he got beaten up by a bunch of Marines. Have you heard this? And if so, do you think or do you know what caused these Marines to beat up Shawn Michaels? I've talked about this story before. There are a few different versions of exactly what happened that night. He was assaulted. That was not makeup. That was a legitimate black. I think he had two black eyes. I've heard different stories. The version that I think, what I think happened is it was him, it was the British Bulldog, and I believe Sean Waltman. And the three of them were out, and I guess they were at a bar maybe or a club or something. And I tend to believe that what probably happened is, you know, the wrestlers, or at least Sean, I could see Shawn Michaels maybe hitting on some girl who was there with her boyfriend. Maybe the boyfriend was one of the Marines, and they were there with their Marine buddies, and they all ganged up and kicked this guy's ass. It's not hard to believe that Shawn Michaels might have been acting like a douchebag back in the mid-90s. It's really not that much of a stretch. But then again, maybe he wasn't at fault. Maybe they just wanted to pick a fight with him. But I'm going to guess something happened that instigated this fight. Now, the WWF version of it is that there were 10 of them. He got beaten up by 10 Marines, and there must have been a police report filed. I'd be curious to know what the police report said. I guess, you know, whatever the police report indicated is probably the truth. Maybe they said 10. I could see them exaggerating that because it just sounds better. Oh, you know, our guy only had his ass kicked because there were 10 of them. And meanwhile, it might have only been like 3. I don't know for sure. But that's what happened. And I think Bulldog and X-Pac got involved. They tried to break it up. And I don't remember if they got hurt in the skirmish. They might have. They didn't get hurt as much as Sean did. And I think Sean may have been concussed. Maybe that's why they wanted to keep him out of the ring. I don't know. They certainly played up the whole concussion thing months later when he came back. He had post-concussion syndrome and all that kind of stuff. But I think he probably was legitimately concussed from the assault. I don't know if they ever caught any of the Marines or if anybody was ever arrested. That's basically what happened. You know, they were out one night. Something happened or something was said. He got beat up. I don't buy that it was 10 of them. But that's the number WWF claimed. And yeah, it's a famous story. Sean from Los Angeles was wondering if you could help me with a debate I'm having with a coworker. We were talking about the Monday Night Wars. And if The Undertaker went to WCW during that time, how different things would be. He thinks that if Undertaker went to WCW, WWF would be the company going out of business because Undertaker was the glue that held the company together during that time. I told him Undertaker going to WCW would be a big blow, but would in no way change the outcome of the war. As the only way WWF would have gone out of business is if someone like Stone Cold had gone to WCW. So, who is right? I would say you are right. I also don't see Undertaker going to WCW as being some kind of mortal blow for WWE. He was kind of the heart and soul of that company, I'll give you that, but I don't know that the mainstream audience really knew that. So it would have been another big defection. It would have made them look bad. It would have been a short-term boost for WCW. But again, you know, WCW, it was a bunch of sharks, man. And I've answered the question before, what if Shawn Michaels had gone to WCW like he wanted to? You know, at one point, Shawn and his dad met with Vince McMahon, and he tried to get his release, and Vince said no. And I think Vince said something to the effect of, you've got like 4 years left in your contract, I'll just sit you at home the whole time. I am not letting you go to WCW. Because that was after the fight, him and Brett, they were pulling each other's hair in the bathroom, and Shawn left, and he claimed unsafe work conditions. There's a lot of that going on at the time. Let's say that they let him go, right? Shawn goes to WCW. Is that the end of WWF? No. But it could be the end of Shawn Michaels. Because you think Shawn Michaels is going to go to WCW and play second fiddle to Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage and be okay with that? I don't think so. It would have been a disaster. And I think Undertaker going, it wouldn't have been a disaster. I think he's a total pro. But I don't think it would have had the kind of effect that your friend or coworker or whoever thinks it would have. I just don't see it. Now, Kevin Nash tells the story that Undertaker came pretty damn close in the beginning of 2000. And by that point, WCW was past the point of no return. Undertaker going to WCW in 2000 would have been an even dumber decision. Because by that point, they were on the way down, and there was no stopping that, you know, that snowball going down the hill. There was no stopping it. But Nash tells the story that they came close. They tried to get Taker in 2000, and, you know, he was going to try to get him a really good money deal, and there were negotiations, and I guess they came close, but then whatever happened, it just didn't work out. And I guess that would have been during the period that Taker was out with the you know, healing up from the injuries right before he came back as the American Badass. And what's interesting about that is Nash says the idea would have been, and here's another reason why it wouldn't have worked. So we're sitting here talking about the Undertaker going to WCW, right? It's not like he would have been able to go with the Undertaker character. He wouldn't have been able to be called the Undertaker. There wouldn't have been an urn. There wouldn't have been any of that stuff. I mean, Scott Hall showed up on Nitro with a toothpick and WWF sued for gimmick infringement. Oh, the accent he's using. Oh, the toothpick. You think they would have let Undertaker go and be even remotely close to the Undertaker character without, you know, taking their ass to court? I mean, WCW was on the way down at that point. I don't think the powers that be at Turner would have been very happy to be dragged into a very expensive court battle with Vince McMahon. So according to Nash, the idea was he'd come in as himself. He was going to call himself Mark Calloway, which is his real name. And the kind of character that he would have would be what turned out to be the American Badass. He'd come in as this badass biker dude going by his real name. I don't think that would have worked. I mean, he made it work in WWF. I know a lot of people hate that gimmick. I kind of, over the years, I've warmed to it a little bit. It's not my favorite version of The Undertaker. But in WCW, it would have died. I just don't think it would have worked. So you can't even call him The Undertaker. You know, that's half his value right there. Hey, we got The Undertaker. Well, no, you didn't. You got Mark Calloway, and there's a big difference between the two of them. So for all those reasons, I just think it would have been a disaster for everybody involved. It would have hurt WWF initially. It would have hurt The Undertaker long term. Look at the legacy this guy's built. Can you imagine if he would have left, you know, and gone to WCW? I'm sure Vince would have taken him back at some point, but it would have been a black mark on his career. I think everybody is probably happy that that didn't happen. Norris from Houston. While watching China's last WWF matches on YouTube, I saw a comment or two about plans to make China and Lita the tag team champions. The assumed idea was for their feud to go the distance and wrap up with the two of them winning respect for one another, and then forging an alliance and winning the tag belts. I've never heard of this before. Was there ever any such plan? If there was, this is the first I'm hearing of it. I also, I've never heard that before. My understanding is China's last match was against Lita. It was at Judgment Day in 01. China did not want to win the women's title. She wanted to fight men. And they wanted to get away from that. And that was also after, you know, Triple H had broken up with her, and, you know, she really didn't have that kind of protection anymore. It's one thing to be dating somebody who, you know, has the ear of the owner and you can kind of get away with certain things. And by that point, the whole Triple H China thing was no more. She lost her big ally. So she didn't have a choice. So she won the women's title. She beat Ivory for it in like a minute at WrestleMania. But I guess she wasn't happy. I don't know if her contract was coming up. Whatever the case was, this was after all the stuff went down with Stephanie. There was obviously a lot of drama, a lot of, I'm sure, bad blood there. China would tell the story that she just wanted to do her own thing and move on. I'm not so sure about that. I'm sure it still bothered her a lot. But whatever was going on, I heard that she demanded more money and she had a big head. I don't know about any of that. All I know is she had the match with Lita. I think the idea was that she would put Lita over as the next champ, as the next big star. She didn't do that. She beat Lita, and then after that, she was gone. That was her last match. That might have been her last appearance, period. So she never did drop the belt. It was very sudden. They let her go. They said, your services are no longer needed. I don't think there was ever any plan to put the tag team belts on her, because I think they knew that, she may not have known, but I think they knew, she's out of here. We don't want her around anymore. And it's very possible that China didn't know that, but I think the die was probably already cast for her after all that Triple H stuff went down and it finally settled down a little bit. And at that point, I think it was just a matter of time. So I've never heard that before. Dick in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Dick in Socket. I know, I'm 5 years old. While watching SummerSlam 1999 on the network, I saw Steve Blackman versus Ken Shamrock inside this cage-like structure that looked a lot like a scaled-down and modified UFC octagon located off the side of the entrance. Has WWE ever used this match outside of SummerSlam 99? If yes, what's the story behind it, and will WWE ever bring this gimmick match back? Well, it was a Ken Shamrock thing. They are not bringing back Ken Shamrock, and therefore they are not bringing back the Lion's Den match. It was called the Lion's Den match. I want to say Shamrock had three of them, I believe, in WWE. Owen Hart was the first. Blackman was the second. And then he had a throwaway one on Raw with Vince McMahon. I think Jeff Jarrett interfered. And I think that was it. I think those were the only three they ever did. I vaguely remember Chris Jericho maybe standing on top of the structure, but I think it was just to cut a promo at a pay-per-view. I don't think he actually wrestled in there. The Lion's Den name comes from the camp that Shamrock used to run in the mid-90s. A lot of fighters trained there. They acknowledged when Shamrock came in, they acknowledged who he was, you know, the world's most dangerous man, according to ABC News. And, you know, he was a big UFC fighter. They even promoted, there was at least one UFC pay-per-view they promoted. They had this agreement. They wouldn't do that today, but they were promoting the UFC pay-per-view that was coming up, and they would talk about Shamrock's fighting background, how dangerous he was. So the whole point of the Lion's Den match was to... It fit the gimmick. It was designed to fit the gimmick, which really wasn't much of a gimmick. I mean, that's who he really was. I thought it was a cool match. I wouldn't mind them bringing it back. I just don't see it happening. Tyler, how would you book Kane's unmasking back in 2003? Or would you have him win the world title? I feel as though this incarnation of Kane was as popular than ever before, and it's a shame he never received a world title run. Well, he did get a world title run, just had to wait 7 years for it. That's the only thing. I wouldn't have done it. You know, you asked me how would I've handled it or booked it. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have unmasked him. I mean, eventually it was going to happen no matter what. But in 2003, you know, I wouldn't have done it. And he did go on to have that great monster run for about, you know, 6 months. And it reinvigorated the Kane character and made him, you know, main event again. So I would have been wrong in thinking that by unmasking him, it would kill his career. I'm still shocked to this day that he didn't get dogged by chance of, you know, Isaac Yankem after that. I know he didn't look exactly the same, but you can kind of tell, and fans can be dicks like that, and they never did that. I never heard one mention of Isaac Yankem. I never saw a sign or anything like that. He put that black towel on his head, and you know, he'd be in chains as he came out. It was something. I mean, he really, I think more so than at any point since probably 2000, maybe 2001, he was booked like a real monster, which is how Kane should be booked. But me personally, I think Masked Kane is the best Kane. Adam from California, buy or sell on the better overall wrestler and performer, John Cena or Randy Orton? Randy Orton. Buy on Orton, sell on Cena. And that's not coming from a Cena hater. I've been castigated by people before. There's a word for you. I've been raked over the coals for even referring to Cena as a great wrestler, and I think he is, just in his own way. But you can't look at all the great matches he's had and ignore them. But he's not Randy Orton. Randy Orton is a fantastic wrestler. He's an even better performer, and what I mean by that is, I mean, he could do moves and stuff like that, you know, a little snap suplex and all that kind of shit. But I just in terms of how he carries himself, his mannerisms, his timing is great. I mean, just, I don't know, for everything. Just the RKOs, and like I said, that little snap power slam thing that he does, and just everything. I know some people think he's, you know, boring as a block of wood, but he just gets it. You know what I mean? He gets it. Cena may be bigger box office, but he's not a better performer overall than Randy Orton is. Joseph from Connecticut. Who had the best worked punches? Bret Hart or Vader? Bret Hart. Who said Vader's punches were worked? Talk to any one of Vader's opponents and ask them if his punches were worked. So the beauty of a Bret Hart punch or a Bret Hart kick, it looked, you know, it looked real. It looked legit, but you know, he wasn't hurting anybody. Yeah, guys have said, oh, you know, this so-and-so worked as light as a feather. And I get the impression that Bret Hart was one of those people. I don't know that anybody would associate working light as a feather with Vader. I think what Vader did looked real because more often than not, it was. So, and Bret Hart had a great punch anyway. Vader's looked absolutely brutal. But like I said, I think that they were a hell of a lot more stiff than Bret Hart. So I guess it comes down to this debate. Can you really say that that is a good... Is he, you know, he's not pulling his punch the way that somebody like Bret Hart would, but isn't that the whole point? Anybody could throw a fucking punch for real. I could punch you in the fucking face. You could punch me in the face. Anybody can do that. So I think that that's kind of what the argument comes down to. But I'm going to go with Bret. I still think Bret, Jerry Lawler is another one, are two of the best punches, you know, just in terms of throwing a realistic-looking punch. I think those two... I'll throw Austin on that list, too. I'm sure there's somebody else I'm forgetting. I'm kicking myself. I wanted to mention somebody else. But Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler were two of the best. Jenkins from Denton, Texas. Even though we're 3 months out from SummerSlam, given how anticipated that Sasha Banks versus Charlotte match is, or whoever is champion by then, I feel this match should main event the show. Especially if WWE is serious about having the women on equal footing as the men. What are your thoughts? Here's my thought on that. If Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins was to be the main event of SummerSlam, if they were going to wrestle for the championship, let's just say, I don't see how you can headline with any match other than that, because that would be a big match. Okay, especially with Rollins having been gone all those months, and now he wants his title back, and that's a big match. I would have to really think about that. But I am not against your idea, and in fact, I would be in favor of your idea. Let's say that's the plan. The plan is to get to SummerSlam and get to a big championship match with Charlotte and Sasha. Even if it was somebody other than Charlotte, I just don't know who that would be. I think ultimately that would be the big match. You're back in Brooklyn. You are in the same building where Sasha had that epic match with Bayley at TakeOver last year. It's exactly 1 year later. That's why I love that story so much. I pitched that idea weeks and weeks and weeks ago before people even started really talking about it. With my idea, you don't just do Sasha and Charlotte at SummerSlam. You have Sasha win. She gets the big win a year later, having suffered that big loss at TakeOver. Now she's rebounded. She's on the main roster. She's the women's champion. You debut Bayley on Raw the next night. They have a little face-to-face in the same building because they're taping Raw at Barclays the next night also. And then you find a way to keep them separate. You have that one little kind of in-ring face-to-face, but you hold off for that Bayley-Sasha match until WrestleMania next year. But to get to SummerSlam, you know Sasha's going to be over like gangbusters, okay? This woman's going to be over like Rover. She goes into that building. She gets the championship match. I think a good part of that crowd would buy into the fact that, you know what, this is the main event. It all depends on how you build up to the match. You've got to tell that story. You've got to build up to it. You've got to have that epic promo package. You've got to take it all the way back to the NXT days and remind people of why this match is such a big deal. Get comments from all the other women, the legends like Medusa. Get comments from Bayley or whoever down at NXT. Really make this thing into a big, big deal. And try to tell that story that 1 year later, Sasha's coming back to this building and she's going to try to rebound and, you know, accomplish her dream and win the ultimate prize. Can you main event SummerSlam with that? I know some people are going to laugh at that, but I think you can. I think you can. Would I do that over Reigns and Rollins if that were the planned main event? I don't know. I don't know, because I would be so tempted. Like that's a big main event right there. I might just decide, you know what, let's go with Rollins and Reigns, but not because, you know, this notion that headlining with the women is laughable. I just think that might be the stronger match. And that also has a great story with Rollins having never lost the title. It's not like it's just a thrown together match. You can't go wrong with either one of those matches. But if you weren't going to do that, you know what? Go for it. Go with Sasha and Charlotte. Go with it. I have no problem with that. I think it's a great idea. Pav from London, England. Buy or sell on who had the better product in 1997? WCW Nitro or WWF Raw? I know WCW is winning the ratings war, but I think WWF had the better wrestling matches. What do you think? Oh, man. It's a hell of a question to end on here. The on-air stuff for both was awesome at that time. 1997 is one of those years. I don't know that I realized it while I was watching it at the time, how great it really was. But when I watch it back now, 1997 was a fucking fantastic year for both companies. I mean, maybe not so much business-wise for WWE. They almost went bankrupt at one point. You know, Vince reneged on Bret Hart's contract because he couldn't afford to pay him. And that paved the way for him to go negotiate with WCW. And then WWE decided to copy WCW and made all their pay-per-views 3 hours and raised their prices. And you would think, oh man, you know, they raised the prices now. People aren't going to buy them. Nope, more people bought the pay-per-views. So they made even more money. And all of a sudden, they were making money. You know, although by that point, Bret Hart already had a deal locked in with WCW. But that's neither here nor there. The point is, the stuff at that time during that year with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, man, you know, it was palpable. Like it came through the TV screen. You got the impression these guys are not out there, you know, acting it out. These guys really don't like each other. And it made it that much more fun to watch. Part of me kind of wishes that the guys now, everyone seems like they get along, right? I'm sure not everybody in the back likes each other, but like everybody gets along. Everybody's a total pro. It's like, fuck, man, come on. Like, I need some guys that like have a beef. Like when Del Rio went off on Sin Cara that one time on Raw, the old Sin Cara, who he used to have a beef with, and then I guess he was cool with, but then this guy, he like jammed his pinky finger. I'm not one to talk, because I probably would freak out too if that happened to me. But these guys are tough. This guy like jammed his pinky or broke his pinky finger, and he was waving the ref down and waving the match off, and Del Rio's like, fuck this, man. You're not ending the match on a fucking broken pinky finger. And he just goes out there. He's kicking the crap out of him. He throws him in the ring. He's beating the piss out of him. I'm like, you know what? We need more of that. That's what we need. We need more unprofessional behavior and guys that just don't fucking like each other. Because back then, you kind of got that sense about a lot of guys. Like, a lot of guys didn't like each other. But Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels in particular, these guys hated each other. But it made for great television, you know? And I'm sure Vince was behind a lot of that. You know, he pit guys against each other. He probably loved it. He loved the drama of it. Hey, it paid off for him, didn't it? It made great television. He made a lot of money off that kind of conflict. So the stuff with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels that was going on, you know, every single week. You know, the Hart Foundation. That was the year of the Hart Foundation faction. Kane's debut, which is still, I maintain, the greatest debut in company history. The rise of Steve Austin, the rise of The Rock, you know, with The Nation and all that. The whole Shawn Michaels Undertaker feud in you know, the fall, and the very first Hell in a Cell match, one of the great matches of all time. And then you look at WCW. And WCW had, I mean, forget they were winning the ratings. Just look at the product, look at the show. WCW had the Cruiserweights, and the Cruiserweights in a lot of ways were carrying that show. I talk to my friend every now and then. We'll kind of reminisce about the Attitude Era, because that's when we used to watch both products and we would talk about it. And he's a casual fan now. He's not really as much into it, but he still, you know, we'll talk about Raw and Nitro, and he'll mention, man, the Cruiserweights, even my dad wasn't a wrestling fan, but when he would see these guys flying around, man, he would sit down, he would watch, he thought it was great. The Cruiserweights had an appeal. It was such a brilliant move on Eric Bischoff. You could say a lot of things about Eric Bischoff. It was so brilliant of him to do that, because he had all these different styles. I mean, you had a two-hour show. Forget, you know, Nitro did go to 3 hours, which was a mistake. But you had this two-hour show. You had a little bit of everything. You want the smaller guys flying around? You got it. You want the more technical guys wrestling like Malenko and Jericho and guys like that? You got it. You want the name stars like Hogan and Savage and Piper and all the guys they would raid and bring over from WWF? You got it. You wanted tag team wrestling? You had the Steiners. You had Harlem Heat. You had the Outsiders. You got it. You got a little bit of everything, except the women. I mean, they tried. They had like a little women's division at one point, but it was kind of a flop. And then Goldberg got hot. Sting was in the rafters. The NWO was running roughshod. DDP came into his own. I mean, you had everything. Now, sometimes they couldn't put it all together. There were weeks where Nitro was practically unwatchable because they let the NWO run roughshod, and it was like, all right, enough already. I mean, even then, the NWO was still hot, but it was also like, all right, we've seen this before. Every week, the same beatdown. And now they're, you know, half an hour goes by, and you haven't seen any matches. They're just kind of fucking with the announcers, and they're acting like a bunch of, you know, goofballs. It got old after a while. But they offered you a little bit of everything. You had the NWO was in full effect. You had Sting in the rafters. DDP's feud with Randy Savage took place in 97. That's kind of an underrated feud. It's just, when you compare the two, it's really close. It's really close. That probably was WCW's best year. And not even probably. 1997, just in terms of the product, the show, probably business. Maybe 98 topped it. Business-wise, but 97 was probably the peak for WCW. That was probably their best year. And, you know, the thing is, I was always a WWF guy. I mean, I grew up on WWF. I favored them. My friend favored WCW. We had some passionate debates, okay? I look back on it now, it's so nonsensical. Like, we never came to blows, but, like, it would get heated. And I look back on it now, and it's like, were we really arguing about this? You know, it's like, you would think I own like stock in the company and they hadn't even gone public yet. But I was. I grew up a WWF guy. You know, I tend to agree with Mick Foley. I think it was Foley who said this, that it was frustrating for them to see WCW winning the ratings every single week because they honestly, truly believed they had the better product, even though they were winning. And I tend to agree. Even though I just got done telling you about how WCW had everything, right? They had the cruiserweights and this and that. But I still feel like week to week in terms of the matches, in terms of the characters, in terms of the stories, I think I would give the edge to WWF. Because WCW had all the pieces, they just couldn't always put it all together. When they did, it was great. I mean, they had a lot of great moments in 97. Luger winning the title on Nitro and that whole big celebration. The whole build-up with Sting, the payoff was disappointing, but the build-up was a lot of fun to watch. And like I said, the cruiserweights as well. So I had my things about WCW that I liked, and I had my things even then that I hated. But I think when you put everything together, the WWF product week to week was just generally stronger and more compelling. And look, just because more people are watching WCW doesn't mean that it's the better show. You know, maybe it was the cooler show. In fact, I know it was. It was definitely a much more hip show. You know, people wanted to see Sting in the NWO. It's like Raw and Lucha Underground now. Raw may have 3 million more viewers or 3.5 million more viewers than Lucha Underground does any given week. But that doesn't mean it's a better show. So I would probably give WWF the slight edge. I'm going to buy on Raw, but just barely. It's so close. Very close. But I can tell you this. We are never going to have another year like that ever again. So that's going to wrap up this mailbag edition of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here this week. Again, I'm out of the country. That's why we are doing this special abbreviated show. We will be back to normal format, normal length. Next weekend, you can keep emailing me your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. It's my handle on there. Don't forget to vote in our Raw poll every Monday night. Thumbs up, thumbs down, as soon as the show goes off the air. And as always, you can buy a shirt in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. You can use our Audible link if you want to get yourself a trial of the service and a free audio book. And make a PayPal donation at any time on thesolemonster.com. Just click the donate button on the right-hand side. And thank you, as always, to everybody who has stuck with me, all of our new listeners. We've picked up quite a few recently. I thank you for your support. We will see you right back here again for a brand new podcast next weekend, available in all the usual places: iTunes, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, Google Play Music, Audio Boom, Podbay, Podcast Addict. We have our own app in the Google Play Store, and everything in between. So we'll see you back here next weekend for a brand new show. Until then, have a great Memorial Day holiday, and we'll see you then. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
I'm just saying, I don't know, with New Day, you got three black guys out there. Why Francesca?
You want to call it Tyrone the Trombone?
Okay, that's racist.
Well, no, it's... I'm just
racist, no.
I'm not racist. Go to Hulk Hogan for that. That's not me.
You know, usually the people that go, I'm not racist, yeah, those are the racists.
Sala Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Sala Monster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Sala Monster sound off.